This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehish Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
the massive influx of South Sudanese refugees into northern Uganda during the past year has strained the country's already overburdened healthcare system. Health centers near the refugee settlements cannot meet the need for maternity care.
That's Halima Atumani reporting. Details coming up.
Also, another suicide bomb attack in Somalia's capital kills at least 15 people as violence escalates in the DRC's Kasai region. Nearly 3,400 people may have been killed in the last 18 months.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story: at least 15 people are reported dead in another suicide bomb attack in Somalia's capital. The Associated Press reports the bomb was hidden in a van that appeared to be a milk delivery truck. It detonated at the Wadajir District headquarters in Mogadishu. Officials say most of the victims are civilians and that the death toll could rise. Al-Shabaab militants have claimed responsibility for the attack. The Africa Center for Strategic Studies calls Al-Shabaab the deadliest extremist group in Africa.
Nearly 3,400 people may have been killed in the last 8 months in the DRC as violence escalates in the Kasai region. According to the AFP, a new Catholic Church report says the death toll stems from violence between security forces and local militia. A papal envoy statement says that 20 villages have been destroyed, 10 by the DRC army, 4 by militias, and 6 by unknown groups. The Catholic Church's findings differ from a recent report from the UN peacekeeping mission MONUSCO. It puts the death toll as 10 times higher than MONUSCO. However, it cites 30 mass graves, while the UN mission says there may be more than 40 in the Kasai region.
As today marks World Refugee Day, a new report finds that migrants can boost economic activity when supported with the basic means to participate in local economies. Researchers from the International Food Policy Research Institute, IFPRI, examined two refugee settlements, one in Uganda and another in Rwanda. They found that migrants in these countries helped boost locally owned businesses in surrounding areas. What's more, Uganda was found to be unique in that it provides one of the more progressive refugee assistance programs in the world. Mattel Filipski is one of the researchers who conducted the study. He said the findings are contrary to the popular belief that migrants take jobs away from local citizens.
Refugees can contribute to their economies in the same way that you and I contribute to our economies, which is mainly two ways: that we work and we spend money. If refugees are allowed to do that, then they will contribute just like other people. So the first point is that many refugees are willing and able and eager to work. So in the refugee camps we visited in Rwanda and Uganda, we met refugees who, for instance, worked as farm workers outside of the camps, but they also have small-scale retail businesses. They sell prepared food. They collect firewood. They make crafts. It can actually be quite elaborate. You know, some refugees repair motorcycles or burn CDs with music, etc. All of this kind of activity creates economic growth. The second point is that the refugees spend money. Most of the time, they spend that money outside of the camp. And so when refugees buy food or buy clothes or buy soap or buy mobile phone credit, all of that is generating business for the host country households.
Also, in getting refugees, helping them to resettle in a new location, what type of support do they need in order to become productive?
Well, that's a very important point. First of all, they need to be allowed to live their economic lives. This is actually not a very common situation around the world. But in Rwanda and Uganda, where we did our studies, the refugees were allowed to leave the camp. They were allowed to trade with the locals. They were allowed to work and to spend their money. And this is how these spillover benefits can materialize. That is the first condition. Now, of course, refugees also receive other kinds of assistance. Typically, they receive shelter, they receive health care, they receive education. But also, they receive aid from the international community, either in terms of food distribution or in terms of cash distribution. And one of the major lessons that we are currently learning is that it is much better in terms of generating positive spillovers for the local economy, it is much better to give them cash rather than food directly. Now, why is that? Well, because when refugees get cash, they are much more likely to go and spend it in the local economy. And that is what generates benefits around them.
Also, what role do farmlands play in helping refugees?
To answer this question, we need to look at the case of Uganda. Uganda has a very interesting and very unique case because it has one of the most progressive refugee policies in the world, in that they not only let refugees settle, they also, whenever possible, allow them to have a piece of agricultural land where they can grow their food. When the refugees are given a piece of land, we find that they are able to grow some food for their own consumption, but also grow some food for sale. And we see very positive impacts, not only on the refugees themselves, but also on the local economy in general, because as they grow these agricultural products, they generate more economic activities. They even sometimes hire local people to help them work on their farm. So all of this, it's a very exciting development.
So then overall, what would you say is the biggest lesson that countries can learn from Rwanda and Uganda in hosting refugees?
I think the primary lesson is really you have to allow refugees to live their economic lives. And that is the best way to benefit from all the productive energies that refugees have.
Mattel Filipski is a researcher for the International Food Policy Research Institute, IFPRI. He spoke with me from Washington.
The massive influx of South Sudanese refugees in northern Uganda during the past year has strained the country's already overburdened healthcare system. Halima Atumani reports from the Ajumina district in northern Uganda, saying health centers near the refugee settlement cannot meet the need for maternity care.
It is estimated Uganda has one doctor for every 24,000 citizens. The nurse to population ratio is not much better, one for every 11,000 people, and much of that staff is concentrated in urban areas. Now add 1.2 million refugees. The United Nations says Uganda received more refugees than any other part of the world in 2016 as civilians fled conflict and hunger in South Sudan, and the influx continues. Refugee Esther Fonay Charles arrived in northern Uganda 8 months ago. She was pregnant and experienced complications during childbirth.
Like myself, I was operated. If you don't have money, you may lose your life and the child too. Because there they want money. Without money, even medicine, you buy even the gloves yourselves, everything in the hospital. So those are the challenges we are facing. Those ones who cannot even afford any coin, so they will just end up losing their life.
Aid agencies and the government have worked to set up temporary health centers in the refugee settlements to serve the huge female population of reproductive age, particularly pregnant women. One refugee settlement called Maji now hosts 15,000 refugees but has no doctor and only 8 medical officers and nurses. Tako Steven is a senior clinician at Maji Health Center 3.
We are unable to conduct planned deliveries here because of the setup of the place. The place is very small. We only conduct emergency deliveries, and yet there are very many pregnant mothers here. So they have to walk all the way from here up to Maji 2 for deliveries.
Some of the referrals are also made to Mungula Health Center 3, where the senior nursing officer, Odaru Judith, says deliveries have more than doubled from 29 to 75 a month. The health center only has 6 midwives.
Our general ward is very small. It has only 10 beds. But the number of deliveries we have in a day, averagely, is 5. And when you take the labor room, it is so squeezed and small that it only fits one bed. And at times you have 3 deliveries at a time. so making it very difficult. You will not even have a place where you can squeeze at least a carpet for a mother to deliver.
At the start of 2017, the government and the UN agencies earmarked $1 million for reproductive health care in the refugee settlements. But the UN Population Fund says they actually need four times as much. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Adjumani, Uganda.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Swoib. 15 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Another suicide bomb attack in Somalia's capital kills at least 15 people. As violence escalates in the DRC's Kasai region, nearly 3,400 people may have been killed in the last 8 months. And the massive influx of South Sudanese refugees in northern Uganda has strained the country's already overburdened healthcare system. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
As temperatures rose this spring in France, so did the number of migrants. And with the official arrival of summer tomorrow, officials are bracing for many more in the coming months. In Calais last night, a fatal accident is being blamed in part on migrants. Reporter Catherine Field is following developments. From Paris, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the accident and other migrant-related issues in France.
It was a van driver who was traveling on the motorway nearby to Calais in northern France, this area where a lot of the migrants go to try and get across to England. The van driver actually crashed into a truck that had been blocked by these makeshift barricades set up by migrants, and the van burst into flames. The driver died. Now, at least for a year, the authorities have been saying someone is going to die up there because of these barricades that are set up at night. What the migrants do is they chop down trees nearby and put them across the road, which forces the truck drivers to slow down. And when the trucks are slowed down, and in some cases, as last night, they've stopped, they will jump in the back of the truck and then hope to make it with the truck as it goes through that channel tunnel from France to the UK. Now, this is the first fatality of a driver on this particular stretch of road. Despite the number of times that the road haulage associations have said, this is dangerous, someone's going to be killed, this is just by chance the first time that this has happened. Overnight, the police have also said they've taken 9 migrants, all of them from Eritrea, into custody, and they're now questioning them on possible charges of manslaughter in relation to this accident.
Catherine, let me take you now to another city in France, the capital, Paris. I understand that the mayor is concerned about not having enough resources to deal with migrants.
Indeed, the mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, has written to the Interior Ministry and the Justice Ministry to say that the way the government's responding to the number of migrants is just not good enough. What she's saying is there's been a huge increase in the number of migrants arriving in Paris since the start of spring, and particularly in the last 2 weeks. And she said the big problem is that, yes, they've got this facility in Paris to welcome them there, to get new arrivals in there, but she said that the government, central government, isn't doing enough to move those people out of there to other areas of France where their papers can be checked, where they can either apply for asylum or apply to join family members in other parts of France. So the main thing that she's saying is they're trying to do what they can. The streets of Paris have got thousands of migrants sleeping out. They're getting them food, they're getting them water, but the government is not doing their part. On top of that, she's also signaled to the government that, yes, not only are there more migrants arriving, but a lot of them are young, unaccompanied men, generally. And she says that the number of young migrants has doubled in the last year. And she's also particularly concerned that the government just isn't giving resources to help these, essentially, kids who have just washed up through whatever means here in Paris. And she's worried because they would very easily fall into the hands of gangs. They are really susceptible to that.
Now, last year, you and I spoke a lot about the various shanty towns that had been set up in various parts of France. by the migrants. I understand now that there are some accusations against police for allegedly mistreating migrants in these shanty towns in a couple of cities. Can you tell me about that?
Again, back in Calais, near that tunnel which goes from France to the United Kingdom, what the authorities had hoped last October when they cleared out what had been known as the jungle where these 10,000 migrants were camped, they hoped that this would mean that they wouldn't come back. Well, of course, weather has gotten better, more are arriving, and there's at least 600 migrants in that area. Now, the human rights groups say that the authorities are just too heavy-handed. There's physical force being used to move these migrants on. As well as that, the charities say the police are stopping them from giving food to these migrants. And on top of that, we're in the middle of a heat wave. The police have now gone in and said that some of these makeshift shower units that have been set up by the charities have to go.
That's reporter Catherine Field from Paris. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. In related news, the number of migrants and refugees who've reached Europe by sea this year has risen above 81,000.
Over the past few days, Egyptian police have raided the homes of those opposing an agreement to transfer control of two Egyptian Red Sea islands to Saudi Arabia. They've arrested dozens of people in Cairo and at least 10 provinces. The group Human Rights Watch says public criticism of the government was effectively banned in Egypt in 2016. The Egyptian parliament also has moved to approve a new law regulating human rights groups. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke to Michael Wahid Hanna, senior fellow at the Century Foundation, about the status of human rights in Egypt.
Obviously, human rights are under a great deal of pressure. Political repression is at all-time highs, and human rights are in a difficult situation. And it's been this way, really, for many years. I would say, importantly, though, that the human rights situation has deteriorated further more recently, after the ascension of the Trump administration. I think Egypt seems emboldened at the moment. It feels as if there are no criticisms or checks. And we've seen some highly repressive steps recently, like the NGO law, which had been prepared and was left unsigned for many months. And they've moved very quickly to put that into practice. And so we've also seen media blackouts, essentially, with many websites now being blocked. So we have a more repressive environment, and the human rights situation is quite dire.
U.S. policies focused for years on stability in Egypt at the expense of democracy and the human rights. Is that still the case?
Well, I think more importantly than U.S. policy are Egyptian policies and Egyptian developments. America can't make democracy in Egypt. They can't force democracy on Egypt. It is, I think, much more relevant to think about what is happening in Egyptian politics and Egyptian society. I think the United States can play a more productive role, a more positive role, and clearly in the big scheme of U.S.-Egypt relations, issues of security and diplomacy have outweighed human rights and democracy. There's no question. And that continues to be the case, even more so now with the Trump administration, which has made very clear that these things are not a priority for them. That being said, the United States, again, has limited means to force those kinds of things on Egypt, and there are no indications of any kind of major political change. Egypt looks to be set on this authoritarian path, and I think it's going to be very difficult, even if the United States was highly intent on doing so, to break that path.
But when the priority of the Trump administration is to fight terrorism, closing off the political space and repression are among the factors behind violent extremism. Is that realized by the Trump administration?
I think U.S. policy can make the situation much worse, and I think it will. What it can't do is make it a whole lot better. I think the signals that Egypt thinks it has gotten from the United States has emboldened them. And as I mentioned, they've taken some highly repressive steps that perhaps they would have thought twice about previously. So again, I think the United States can have a negative contribution, and I think that's clearly the case now. And this administration is not concerned about democracy. It is not concerned about human rights. It is not concerned about political repression. It's not particularly concerned about issues of pluralism. And as such, the Egyptian regime is going to operate accordingly. And we see that now, and I think that's going to continue.
That was Michael Wahid Hanna, Senior Fellow at the Century Foundation.
The World Meteorological Organization reports the planet Earth is experiencing another exceptionally warm year, with record-breaking temperatures occurring in Europe, the Middle East, North Africa, and the United States. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WMO headquarters in Geneva.
At least 60 people have been killed in the devastating forest fires in central Portugal. The World Meteorological Organization says one of the factors contributing to these runaway wildfires are very high temperatures that have exceeded 40 degrees Celsius. Extremely high temperatures also have been recorded in Spain and in France, which issued an amber alert, the second highest alert level, on Tuesday. WMO reports near-record heat is also being reported in California and in the Nevada deserts. Meteorologists report North Africa and the Middle East are experiencing extremely hot weather, with temperatures topping 50 degrees Celsius. But WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis says the hottest place on Earth appears to be the town of Turbat in southwestern Pakistan, which reported a temperature of 54 degrees Celsius in May.
It seems like this is a new temperature record for Asia. If it's verified, it will equal a record which was set in Kuwait last July. So we will now set up an investigation committee to see if that indeed is a new temperature record for the region.
WMO senior scientist Omar Badour says the world heat record of 56 degrees Celsius was recorded in Death Valley in the United States in 1913.
It's very difficult to break a world record because it's not easy to have all the conditions in terms of pressure, invasion of air together at one place and break that record. So the concern now, we are close to cross that record. Now 54, we are not that far.
The World Meteorological Organization says it expects global heat waves will likely trigger more deadly wildfires. If people do not take necessary precautions, it warns many people will die from the heat, as happened in 2003 when heat waves across Europe killed 70,000 people. Scientists predict climate change will cause heat waves to become more intense, more frequent, and longer. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
After the Vatican recently announced Pope Francis would not visit South Sudan this year, it says the Pope will travel to Peru and Chile next year. He'll visit both countries in January. Francis is scheduled to visit Colombia this September, but a planned visit to India may be postponed until next year. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhiba in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next, Straight Talk Africa, a preview of the Kenyan presidential election. The race between incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta and Raila Odinga. The main opposition candidate is looking increasingly competitive. A discussion on Kenya's presidential election on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.